Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. We first brought you Jonathan Hall's story on December 2nd, 2019. To refresh your memory, we'll play the original episode first, with the update at the end. If you remember this story well, you can fast forward to around the 1 hour mark, where the update begins.
He doesn't like conflict. He doesn't like to argue or fight with people. I mean, something just don't make sense why he just vanished. And everybody says that. You know, we can understand him not calling his brother and his sister, but we cannot understand why you, because he knows how much I worry about him, and he worries about me. He's the only kid of mine. He's never talked back to me. He gets upset when the other two kids upset me, you know? He gets upset when he knows I'm upset. So I know if he knew I was hurt like this, he wouldn't be doing this on purpose. This is not what he would do. This is not him. That's why it hurts so bad, because I know he wouldn't be hurting me like this. Something's causing it to happen. Either memory or something. I don't know. He could be being held.
On Wednesday, February 13th, 2019, 30-year-old Jonathan Hall went to work with his dad, who was a maintenance man in Las Vegas, Nevada. Jonathan worked at his side, and at the end of the day, his father dropped him off at home, and Jonathan left to go to his second job at a local billiards club not too far away. Jonathan was seen at the club that night, playing on the slot machine and the pool tables. But after that evening, there's been no activity on his phone, and no trace of what happened to Jonathan that night. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 202 of The Vanished, Jonathan Hall's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Jonathan Hall was a 30-year-old native of Mississippi who had lived there for most of his life with his mom and siblings. He struggled to make friends and achieve academically in school, but wanted to be independent when he was an adult. At 23, he moved to Las Vegas, where his dad resides, and started working two jobs to save money for a place of his own one day. We spoke to John's dad, Stephen, for this story, and he told us about some of John's strengths and some of his challenges.
He does have a little bit of a speech impediment, but not so that you would notice anymore. When he was younger, he was a little more prominent, but as time has gone on, he's learned to overcome it. His speech is very well now, but he has low self-esteem. He doesn't feel like he's smart enough or good enough, big enough, strong enough. So I was trying hard to help him overcome that and get him to where he would be a little better about it. He's more than capable. He's plenty smart enough, but he just doesn't realize it. Heck, he's some ways smarter than I am.
John's dad, Stephen, worked a maintenance job at a local mobile home park, doing upkeep on the property, managing the landscape, and responding to routine maintenance requests. John worked alongside him, learning new skills. When we talked to Stephen, he told us that John wasn't too fond of the work, but kept at it anyway.
He doesn't want to work real hard, especially manual labor. If it's working at the queue, playing pool, he was okay with that. Manual labor, he's not really big on manual labor. I tried to get him to work here at this mobile home park, but I'm the maintenance manager, and I wanted him to clean up and sweep the leaves last fall around the park, around the clubhouse and stuff. And he really didn't like doing that. He did it, but he wasn't real happy about it. He was with me about 99% of the time. We were together, and I was kind of training him on how to do these things. So a lot of electrical outlets and photocells that needed to be replaced and things like that. And a lot of tree trimming and yard work. So, of course, it was in the wintertime, so we weren't mowing the grass and trimming the grass and stuff all that much. But there was plenty of other things to do. We have some certain amount of vacant mobile homes here, and we have to try to keep the homeless guys out. We have a heavy homeless population in this city because of the weather.
We also spoke to John's friend, Eric. He was able to shed some light on John's life in Las Vegas.
I've known him for about 10 years. His sister is my son's mom. I mean, he's a pretty laid-back guy and everything. He likes to play pool. Doesn't really go out and party much at all. Yeah, I've never really just seen him go out and party. He likes to sit at the house. Pretty simple, laid-back guy, pretty much. He liked pool. He liked hanging out with his family. He lived in Las Vegas here for the past 7-8 years or so. I live over here in Memphis, Tennessee area, but I came over there to visit him a few times. He seemed to be doing pretty good. He seemed to enjoy it there. I could tell he missed his family back home. He seemed to be enjoying it pretty much there.
Despite John's admission that he missed his family at home in Mississippi, he liked his semi-independent life in Las Vegas and enjoyed getting to work and didn't seem to want to move back. Eric shared what John's reaction was like when he offered him a ride back to Mississippi.
When I was there, I tried to get him to take off and leave and come back with me so I could bring him back over here to where his mom and everybody lives. But he would not do it. He was set on enjoying being there. He was scared too because he felt like he was going to be, when he came back here, he wasn't going to leave. And he wanted to go back to Las Vegas. I think he just liked being out there in Vegas, over there closer to his dad. I don't know, just something that he wanted to do for a little while, be back closer with his dad, because his dad left when they were younger, moved away. And I don't know, I guess he just kind of missed being around his dad, so he enjoyed doing that.
In the years prior to his disappearance, John had faced some serious challenges with his mental health and was even hospitalized in a mental health facility in 2015. Despite these obstacles, John continued to work on his efforts to move past the things that he struggled with most of his life. He kept himself busy working a couple of jobs and hanging out with his friends who worked at and spent their free time at a local bar and club known as the Las Vegas Q Club. This bar is where John worked his second job and also spent a good deal of his free time, playing slots or shooting pool in the club's pool league. John's mom, Anna, talked to us about John's time working at the club.
He got that job at the Q Club. He worked at Q Club, I guess, about 4 years. He did have issues with one of the dudes who took another manager's place. And the other manager, was real close to John and basically let John work whatever hours he wanted, as long as he did the job. He got paid. It didn't matter how long it took him to get it done, he would get paid. Well, this new guy came up in there and tried to change all the rules on John and try to cause a lot of problems with John. And he even got up in John's face and called him names and stuff and tried to provoke a fight with him one night at the Q Club after hours, I guess. They were all having a few drinks. And John called me. See, that's what I'm saying. He calls me when something stresses him out or upsets him. He tries to avoid confrontation. So he called me and was telling me all this. And I, you know, I calmed him down and told him, look, don't stoop to this guy's level. You know, go talk to the, you know, the man above him, because the man above him is who hired you and told you, you know, you could have that shift and you could do this this away. And then John ended up doing that. So, and then this, supposedly him and the guy ended up being able to be civil from that point on. And this happened last year. So they supposedly were civil this year. So other people in the Q Club said John was, he was a hard worker. He was quiet. He was always smiling. Everybody loved John.
John's friend Eric expressed some concern that John may have continued to struggle making friends and working on his mental health.
I mean, he's just pretty much, he's like depressed and stuff, but he seemed to be gotten over that and everything. He just seemed like he was alone all the time, so he just got depressed. Yeah, he had a few friends up there at the Q Club that we worked at. You know, like I say, he's not a very sociable person outside of his certain amount of friends, because, you know, that's just, he's very careful about who he's friends with, you know. But he had a few friends there. He doesn't really just care to just like meet random people and just go boss it all out, hanging out with somebody that he doesn't really know too well. He likes to be comfortable around people that he's with. Yeah, I went up there and met a few of them when I was in town. I mean, they seemed all right. I mean, and I didn't really know them too much. You know, I just met them myself. But they seemed like pretty decent people.
Despite having few friends, John very much enjoyed spending his evenings at the Q Club, working or just hanging out. John's dad, Stephen, often dropped John off at the club or even joined his son for a round of pool. This is what he told us about his son's favorite spot to spend his free time.
He got that job working at the Q as part-time. So he loved to play pool. He loved playing pool. He's real good at it. He's good at playing pool. He was up there every day playing pool. They gave him a job working there. He'd help the bartenders and... He's over 21, of course, so he was playing in the tournaments in the pool leagues, two or three leagues at a time, and that's where you get the gambling. And they, of course, this is Las Vegas, so they have these poker machines and other gambling machines there at the bar. So he would go there at the bar and put a couple of dollars and lose it, put a couple more. It don't take long until your paycheck's gone.
The Q Club is also where John was on the night of his disappearance. We don't know much about that night, when he arrived or when he left, and the club management declined to speak with us for this story. We do know that this is the last place that he was seen, as an employee reported to John's parents that they saw John at the bar around 7:30 p.m. on the evening of February 13th, but they weren't certain when he left. Anna told us about the events leading up to that day.
He just turned 30 in February, right before all this happened. He's real quiet, shy, very routine, stays on pattern. He stays in touch with me constantly. I mean, we text or call each other every day. And we've always had a deal that if I ever didn't hear from him for 2 days in a row, he told me to be sure to start looking for him or even to be concerned. So my last contact with John was February 12th. I'd sent him a text telling him goodnight, love you. And he said, goodnight, love you too. And on February 13th, I kept trying to text him because I never didn't hear anything from him all day. And the reason I got concerned at that point was because on February the 8th, I believe it was a Friday, right before his birthday, he had called me, but he did a video conference. Like that evening, which is not him. He doesn't just normally call me at night doing a video conference. And he chatted with me on video for almost an hour. And he seemed very agitated. To be quite honest, I thought he looked like he'd been crying. He was fidgety. I knew that maybe he might have been possibly just to have a mental breakdown, because that's the way he acted when he had his last breakdown about 4 years ago, when he was living in Denver with his sister. And normally, you know, he calls me to calm him down and stuff, but he really wouldn't open up to me and tell me anything was going on. He just said he was very tired. You know, he worked two jobs. He worked morning with his dad Monday through Friday at a trailer park as a maintenance. After he'd get off there, he'd go home, get a few hours of sleep, and then he'd go into graveyard at Q Club. So I kind of think, okay, well, maybe he is just tired and, you know, maybe didn't get enough sleep. But, you know, I'm his mother, and I can tell something wasn't right with him. I mean, that's why I even started screenshotting pictures of him. I'm like, because I felt something then. I said, something's not right. And I kept begging him to try to, you know, open him up, get him to talk to me. He just kept kind of lingering on the phone, and I wasn't going to get off with him because I knew something was bothering him. So I kept trying to get it out of him. So about an hour into the, you know, it was like 58, 59 minutes, he finally said he wanted to get off and try to go get some sleep. And I did not want to get off the phone with him because I felt like something just wasn't right. But then again, if he's working two jobs, not getting enough sleep, I thought, okay, maybe he is just tired and fidgety. So the weekend comes. Well, matter of fact, when that happened, I called my daughter. And I said, look, you need to call your dad because his dad lives in Vegas. I said, you need to let him know. John's not acting himself. He acts like, you know, he might be just have a breakdown. Something's going on. Something's bothering him. Of course, she knows how her dad is. She's not going to waste her time calling her dad because they always think I'm being too overprotected or too paranoid. I'm not. I'm his mother. He calls me when something is going wrong or going down, you know, calming down. But, so she never did say anything to her dad. So here we go. Saturday, Sunday. It was his birthday. I did talk to him on his birthday. He was very kind of short with me. And then Monday comes. Tuesday, he was acting odd those days, like as far as texting. He wasn't even calling me. He was just texting me. So I did talk to him on the 11th, but it was a short conversation. It's like, you know, he was at work. I'll get back with you. You know, when I get home, I'll call you back, which he never did. That's why I got concerned too, because the next day, instead of calling me, he texted me instead of telling me, you know, he called me that night. So 2 days just kind of being short with me. So Wednesday comes, and I guess his dad started getting concerned, or maybe he only got concerned because I then said, you know, I said, look, something's not right. I didn't hear from him the 12th, you know, no phone call, just a text. I didn't hear from him all day on Wednesday. I tried to call him. His phone was off. It was like somebody, like the phone got turned off. And it was being turned on a couple of times and then turned back off. John never used to do that. He don't just turn off his phone and turn it back on. So then Thursday, same thing was going on. So by Friday, the dad decided he would go file a police report because he couldn't find John either. And he couldn't get in touch with him. So he goes and files a police report of a missing, you know, son. Dad had him Wednesday. He worked supposedly with his dad Wednesday. His dad claims he took him home, dropped him off at the house. Normally, John would go in the house and go on the bed because he knew he had to go to graveyard, I guess, at the Q Club that night. But for some reason, several days later, we found out someone at the Q Club said, oh, no, he was up at the Q Club until about 7:30 that evening. And he was just playing those slot machines and, you know, just hanging out. Didn't seem like nothing was wrong with him, they said. And that was the last day seeing him. So apparently they at Q Club seen him last, not his dad.
That evening at the club was the last time that John was ever seen. When John's dad couldn't reach him, at first he wasn't too worried. His son is an adult, and he had been unable to reach John for short periods of time in the past. He thought that's what was happening again. But as time continued to pass, he started to worry.
Sometimes I'd try to call him, and I'd get his answering machine for several hours. I'd get a little concerned, but then eventually he'd call me and say, hey, come get me. So that's why I wasn't really concerned when he came up missing, because I thought that he was probably off drinking or something. But after a few hours, I started really getting concerned. And by the next day, I knew he was gone. Personally, if this is what he wants, then, you know, I'm okay with it. As long as it's his own decision and that's what he wanted. You know, he's 30 years old, and I just wish he would have sent me a text or email or called me on the phone and say, hey, I'm headed in another direction. You know, I love you, but I've got to go do something. So, you know, and that had been fine as long as I knew. I think he didn't want to talk to me or send an email or a text message because he didn't want me to talk him out of it. And I probably would have. I think this is a bad move. I mean, he was doing real well at both jobs. He was saving money. And that was another problem. He liked to gamble a lot. That may be a real reason why he disappeared. And I'm guessing that he's not even in town anymore. I don't think he even is here. I think he's gone somewhere, anywhere, Los Angeles. You know, who knows?
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. After Jonathan vanished and no one was able to reach him, his friend Eric and Jonathan's sister Hannah went to the house where Jonathan had been living, looking for any clue that might point to where he had gone, or at least given some insight that his family could pass on to the police, as they had not yet conducted a search of the home. Here's Anna on that.
My daughter goes out there a few weeks later. I think it was like the beginning of March. She goes to the house. She gets in the room, looking around, trying to find any suicide note or any evidence that Dom, you know, was mentally distressed or whatever. Anyway, while there, they had found what looked like blood on some stuff. So they reported it. And at this time, we had hired a PI. So a PI was with my daughter when she went over there to, you know, check out John's room and everything. And I suggested she, you know, turn him into the detective. So she did, and of course they sent the CSI crime scene investigators out there. A few days later, did like a 4 or 5 hour search. They did tubs, they did sinks, they did the whole entire house. Said they can find no evidence of any kind of struggle, foul play that went on in that house. Nothing, you know, looked out of the ordinary. Nothing was cleaner than the other. But we honestly think if anything happened, it happened outside the house, not inside the house. And I try to ask the detective information about that crime scene report. You know, did anybody check outside the house, around the house? Because his dad also contacted me after my daughter had left there and told me that I needed to get on to the detective and tell him that he needs to go check out the big garbage cans on the side of the house. Because when he was cleaning out some stuff, he noticed what he thought was blood inside the trash can, like little runs of stuff, you know. We had pictures. We sent it to the detective. He said it didn't look like blood to him. And basically, he wouldn't send anybody out there to check it.
John's friend Eric told us about the trip to Las Vegas that he made, hoping to find some trace of John.
His mom and sister told me that he hadn't, nobody's heard from him in a little while. So that's why I tried to reach out to him. I got a plane ticket for me and his sister to fly down there to go see if we can find him or find any leads or anything. Well, we got a hotel at the casino. We went around town, asked questions. We went to different hospitals. We went to his, where he lives at, trying to see if we could find any kind of evidence of foul play or anything like that. I talked to his dad a little bit. I went around and checked a couple homeless shelter areas.
With no sign of John, Eric and Hannah turned to the police for help.
They ended up coming at the very end to help out a little bit. I mean, they seem to think that he just, like, ran away. To me, that's what it seemed like the police were just kind of looking at, like, it's just somebody else that ran away because there's no foul play that looked like there. And they fingerprinted the house and ran some dye or whatever up there to see if there's any blood or anything like that. Looks like a bachelor pad for sure. But as far as, like, his room and everything, what seemed odd to me is that, you know, he's a smoker. And, you know, he ain't a very rich guy either. And for him to, like, leave a carton of cigarettes behind to just go vamp out and leave and run away just didn't seem likely. To me, it looked like he was with somebody he trusted or left with somebody that he trusted and was planning on coming back and never came back. I personally think that one of his friends went to pick him up because he didn't have any call logs or anything with somebody coming to pick him up. So he must have had somebody at the Q Club tell him, hey, I'm going to be over there in 5 minutes to pick you up or whatever. And then just showed up and picked him up and never came back with him. I'm not sure if it was an accident, something happened like that or what, but I'm pretty certain somebody picked him up that he trusted.
After the initial search of the house and a few interviews with those in John's life, Anna and John's dad, Steve, stopped hearing from the police. Their calls to law enforcement have gone unanswered and unreturned. We were hoping to speak to the local police for this story so that we could hear their side of things, get their perspective on where John could be and what they've been doing to find him. Unfortunately, the Las Vegas Metro Police Department declined our request for an interview and sent us a heavily redacted missing persons report with no useful information. But we're not the only people they've ignored. Here's John's dad, Stephen, on that.
I haven't talked to Officer Siegel for quite some time. Their caseloads of their work is, well, they've got so many homeless people here in this city. Seems like every month there's several that go missing. So he hasn't responded to me. I've left messages in the past with no response. So I think after so many months, they just move on. They just have so many. You know, they're just overwhelmed with the homeless population.
When we spoke to John's mom, Anna, she shared a few events that occurred leading up to John's disappearance that she believes are more than coincidental and outright strange. A couple of weeks before Jonathan vanished, he had come home from work to find an intruder had broken into the home he shared with his brother, and that the person was still inside. His mom, Anna, recounted what John had told her about the incident.
Mid-January, John came in from his graveyard shift. And at this time, John had a bad cell phone. It wouldn't hold a charge. It kept, you know, wouldn't stay charged. He walked into the house, and there was an intruder in the house. Remember, it's graveyard, so it's like 3 or 4, I guess, in the morning. You know, it wasn't daylight yet. He walked in the house. Luckily, John had a CCW license. He carried his weapon. He walked in. There was an intruder in their kitchen. He said the boy looked like he was 14 or 15 years old. John had his gun pulled on him. He couldn't call the police or nothing because they didn't have a phone in the house. There's no home phone. His cell phone was dead. He said, the only option I had to do, I gave this boy a speech, said, I look, you're young. You need to, you know, get your life straight, man. This is not the way you want to live your life. I could have walked to him, shot you dead, and you'd be gone. He goes, but I don't want to kill you. I want you to, you know, get out of my house and don't come back. Because the next time, if you do come back, you won't be this lucky. I'm not going to let you walk out of here. So, he escorted the boy out, the young guy out. Now, right after that happened, I went and got John a brand new phone and sent it to him for his birthday, early birthday present, because I was so afraid if something happened like that again, he couldn't call for help. And I mentioned that to the detective, and he goes, well, he found it really unlikely that that same person's going to come back and try to retaliate on Jonathan. He goes, if he did something to him, he goes, he didn't come in the house and take anything of value. Well, first of all, there's nothing in the house of value. There's two, bachelors living in the house. They have like very small screen TVs, nothing fancy, couches. I mean, there wasn't nothing to really take for value in the house. So I still kind of wonder if that guy didn't come back and jump my son on the way into, going into the house. But again, we don't know. Crime scene was investigated. We don't know what was checked outside. I don't have any proof that, that guy could have came back and did something to John. It's crazy. It was a month later to when it happened. And that did cause John a lot of paranoia, according to his brother. When they did question the brother said John was very paranoid. Every night he'd come in, he'd do a sweep of the house ever since that guy broke in.
Shortly before his disappearance, John had started hanging out with a couple of new friends he had made at the billiards club. John worked with his dad every day on the maintenance job and kept in contact with his mom via text or phone call daily. His mom, Anna, told us that she hadn't ever heard of these new friends until after John disappeared, but that his phone records told a different story. We asked Anna to tell us what she knows about John's friends.
There's a guy on there named Roger who says he's John's best friend. Him and his girlfriend, Lacey, are best buddies of John, which is kind of odd because John really never mentioned them to me for someone that's such close friends of his. I mean, that kind of made me curious because there was a lot of text messaging between the two of them for the last few weeks before John went and disappeared, or he disappeared. Okay, you're his best friend. Y'all were with him these last few weeks before he just up and vanished. It just don't make sense. And I mean, got the proof on the phone messages. Look how many text messages there were of him and Roger back and forth his birthday weekend, the weekend before that. I mean, John, and then there's never any messages like that in the previous bill, before that. They just became awful quiet close with him in around December, like more activity on the phone bill with them, with Roger. They were in a lot of contact with him right before all this. I mean, they were with him the two weekends partying with him. And that's just not John. He's not a party person. Why was he partying all of a sudden? Why was he wanting to party? What had him so down to make him want to go do this? It's like almost like peer pressure. I know he's an adult. I get that. But he's an adult who's had mental issues.
When John moved to Las Vegas, he shared a home with his father and brother. Eventually, his dad moved out, hoping to give his son some independence, with the goal that they would one day live on their own. However, John and his older brother, Steve Jr., did not get along well or enjoy each other's company. John's mom, Anna, told us what she knows about their relationship.
Dad claims the brother that lives in the house with him, which is his half-brother, they don't get along very well at all. There's a lot of childhood issues there where he tortured John when John was a little boy. There's a big age difference. So John had an issue with that brother. And he was already mad because his dad let him come live there in the first place. It was already, kind of an uneasy situation for John being around dude. Dad was living at the house until last December or November. He moved out and left the two boys there, which was not a good idea in the first place. But him and his wife moved out into that trailer park where their managers are running the trailer park. And John had an issue with that, according to the Q Club. He told people up there that, he was uneasy about living with his brother. He didn't like being in the same house with him. John had a deadbolt and pretty much, lock on his door. So he would stay locked up in his room whenever his brother was around. They didn't hang out.
According to Anna, after the frightening home invasion in January, John was often scared that there might be another break-in, and sometimes locked himself in his room and kept a gun nearby for safety. In one incident, shortly before he disappeared, John was in his room and heard a loud noise that sounded like someone was in the house again. Just as he had when the home was broken into before, John went to investigate. Anna explained to us what he found.
John did pull a gun on his brother because he heard in the middle of the night, his brother wasn't even home, supposed to be home, but he kept hearing something like bang around in a room. So he got up with his gun and walked in there, and it was his brother. He didn't, you know, he didn't shoot him, of course. He just was ready if he had to, if it was an intruder again. He thought it was an intruder because he was making so much banging racket that he thought somebody was trying to break in again. So he apologized to his brother and everything, but his brother did get pretty pissed off about it. I mean, I guess I would too. He might pull a gun on me, but, you know, knowing the situation, you knew somebody just broke into y'all's house a few weeks before that, you'd be paranoid too.
John's dad, Steve Sr., also acknowledges that the two brothers didn't get along well, but they seemed to tolerate each other. After John disappeared, Steve Jr. appeared to be a person of interest in John's case because of some of his odd behavior and lack of interest in finding John or cooperating with the police by giving an interview. Here's their dad, Steve Sr., on their relationship with each other.
He was living at the house there on 10th Street, which is my house. Him and Steve Jr. were living there together, and I didn't charge him any rent. I paid for the utilities and the insurance and everything, and they didn't have to pay for anything, either one of them. I just wanted them both to save some money and get their lives started. I wanted both of them to be able to get enough money to move out on their own. Steve, he didn't get along too good with them, but it wasn't like they were bitter enemies either. You know, they just didn't really have anything in common. And Steve Jr. definitely had some mental issues of his own. And they didn't really talk a lot. They didn't get along.
Strangely, shortly after John disappeared, so did Steve Jr. This seemed more than coincidental, but Steve Jr. had spent most of the last decade homeless, according to his dad and Anna. To Anna, Steve Jr.'s sudden disappearance made him look even more suspicious than some of his actions in the past. This is what she had to say.
The son went missing. Also, a few weeks after John went missing, his brother went MIA. Because they wanted to interview him, and he knew they wanted to interview him. So he went missing. So he made himself look like a suspect, first of all, because he didn't want to talk with the detectives or the PI. So weeks went by, several weeks, and we finally got him found. The detective and his captain, I think he said, they spoke with him, made a comment he was an odd character, which we know he's mentally ill. He does have mental issues, that guy does, his brother. But they said they couldn't say for 100%. They're not 100% sure that he was not involved, but it's unlikely that he was involved. For someone to be his age, just become violent all of a sudden and try to kill his brother out of the blue, just seems very odd to them. It's basically how he worded it. So therefore, he mentioned doing a polygraph on the brother, and so the brother said he agreed to do it. Again, I kept asking the detective over and over, like several times throughout the, messaging, emails and stuff. Did you ever do that polygraph? Did you ever find anything out on the brother? And he still wouldn't answer me still for the longest time. And he still didn't answer that question. He didn't answer that question. That question did not get answered either.
After a few weeks with no trace of John or his brother, the detective working on John's case told their father that he had come across Steve Jr. in one of the police department's routine canvasses of the homeless population.
I know that once Steve Jr. got fired from his job for some kind of sexual harassment, he knew that I wasn't going to approve, that I'd be mad at him. So he just left. He said, well, that's it. My goose is cooked. And he took off. That was not a good move on his part. I was pretty mad when I found out about it. It's part of the Missing Persons Bureau here in Las Vegas. A policeman, he came by here where I work, and I talked to him a little bit, and He gave me a great big stack of pictures of John to distribute. And at that time, because see, they were kind of concerned that Steve Jr. may have had something to do with John's disappearance. But they ruled him out because they caught up to him and they found him with the homeless guys. Officer Siegel told me at that time, if John is still in town here, that eventually they would find him because they go through the homeless community pretty often and look for people because there's criminals out there that are trying to hide. And so they go through the homeless population and weed them out. They found Steve Jr. They questioned him. They determined that he was okay. They ruled him out as a suspect of any kind. I was the one that put him on to Steve Jr. as a suspect because of the way he, you know, he's really different. He's got a bit of a temper sometimes.
According to U.S. Census data, Las Vegas has a resident population of approximately 640,000 people. A local newspaper, the Las Vegas Sun, reports that more than 42 million tourists come to visit every year, making it much more difficult to find a missing person in a sea of people. Anna says that there have been several sightings and many tips submitted by people who believe they have seen John. There are a few in particular that she believes may have actually been John.
We've had about 7 tips come through, leads, and I guess about a month ago, they sent me a picture that someone sent them. And of course, everybody keeps sending these pictures. They're not getting clear pictures. We're getting kind of blurred pictures. But this boy did look just like my son. His facial, you know, what we could tell of the face, the body stance and everything looked just like my son. So Red Rock Search and Rescue, you know, went out there, approached the guy, talked to the guy, and the guy was given the name as Bruce or Bryce or something like that. Yeah, Bryce. And said that, you know, he's sorry he wasn't Jonathan. And they even, I said, you know, how you know he's, you know, not given a fake name or whatever. So they actually went to an extra step and had me be able to talk to the guy on the telephone. And of course, when I first started, you know, talking to him, I knew right then he wasn't Jonathan. His voice was not my son. But because of that guy being the one they found last time, they seem to think the other tips are still the same guy. So nobody's wanting to go out and check the tips I just got Friday and Saturday of him being out in that area. Because the first tip that came in April the 20th was a picture a lady took through a drive-thru at Raising Cane restaurant. And when she took those pictures, they were bad pictures because she was taking it out of her rear-view mirror while she's in the drive-thru. He was standing back by the dumpsters. So it wasn't very good pictures, but there's one picture that's a side angle that looked identical to one of John's pictures that I have of him on how he looks and that little smirk, kind of a smirk with his eyes that he does. And I said, man, that is him. I'm telling you, that is my son. So again, we just got the same tip. So actually 2 people sent me a message this weekend. Actually 3 people. I had to rethink that. There's 3 of them. And 2 of them said, hey, we're 99% sure that is your son. And we're looking at the flyer. And this is, you know, this is what he looks like. You know, they gave a description. And then the other person, you know, said the same thing, that he was sitting out in front of her where she worked at up in that mall. There's a big mall there, a big, like a big strip mall. And it's pretty big. So he can go from place to place and get lost. You know, people wouldn't find you if you're walking fast. But he was also seen there, you know, with a homeless sign in his hand, trying to get money, and had a religion pamphlet or something in his other hand, reading it, which John was religious. He was pretty religious with it because his dad is Mormon. And when he first moved out there, he was big time into the church with his dad. At first, they did a lot of Bible reading. I even got a thing where he wrote down a bunch of scriptures in his little pad that my daughter had brought back. He knows God and all that, and he reads stuff like that. So that could have been him. I mean, she said she was pretty, you know, like 90% sure that lady said, and the other lady said 99%. There was another one that come through where a lady said her son's homeless too. And he sat next, because she showed him the flyer. She said, "Have you seen this guy in here? You know, why you been out on the street?" Because, you know, he was homeless, out on the streets. And his eyes got really big, she said. He told his mom, "Hey, you know, I just sat on the bus next to him yesterday." He strike up a conversation with the guy, and the guy said he relapsed and stuff on drugs, and he worked at the Cheesecake Factory. That tip I didn't really take too serious, because a lot of things that she was saying did not fit Jonathan. Jonathan didn't have a drug problem, and she had asked me did he have bad teeth and stuff. John didn't have bad teeth 8 months ago, and she just said, you know, maybe he had like these scars, like acne maybe scars, which he didn't have that either.
With so many visitors per year coming into the Las Vegas area, it's hard for police to track these sightings. Still, Anna and the missing persons volunteer group she works with have passed out flyers extensively and passed on information about all of the credible sightings to the police. None of them have been confirmed to be John. Earlier, John's dad brought up that John used to enjoy gambling on those slot machines at the Q Club. His mom, Anna, doesn't believe that John had a gambling problem, and she also doesn't think he would have had gambling debts to run from. She believes that this was nothing more than something that he did for fun, and in her eyes, she wouldn't classify it as a gambling addiction.
When the dad did the TV, because there was a TV, media did an interview of the dad and my daughter while she was in Vegas, the dad made the comment, "My son had a gambling problem." He made it sound like it was a serious gambling problem. It was not a serious gambling problem. John would take the money he made at the Q Club, and yes, he played the slots with it at his job. He didn't go from casino to casino. He didn't pawn stuff. When John went missing, he had money in the other bank, his bank account, because his dad's job was making direct deposit into that bank account. So if somebody had an addiction, I would think his bank account would have been drained. He used his second job paid to do his playing with. I mean, I don't know. I don't think he made a whole lot of money, but he made enough to play slots with. He did love the slot machines.
Anna doesn't believe her son would just walk away and thinks it's far more likely that John met with danger or was taken by someone intending to cause him harm. There are several reasons that she doesn't believe he would just walk away.
I don't see him doing that and not calling me. He's always called me every time he went had a breakdown. But the thing that gets me is he supposedly walked away from his brand new moped that he was so proud that he finally bought himself something with his money. That he was, you know, that was bought with his money because dad pays all the bills at the house. He doesn't pay bills. Dad paid them. So he actually took his money and, you know, went out and bought him a nice moped. I don't see him just walking away and leaving that. And his cigarette, because he's a really big smoker. I mean, he smoked cigarettes. And there were cigarettes still left in his room. There was no sign of anything really missing that was important to him. Like, he had five or six silver rings and a bracelet. The only thing, I don't know if it was found or not, was a necklace. But my daughter brought me all the rings back and his bracelet. So he up and left all that stuff. I just don't believe that. I don't believe he just walked out of there and planned on being gone and not coming back and never contacting me or his dad. Even though me and his dad have history, he still was close to his dad because his dad was the only person out there to help him. There was no other family member that was helping him as far as get a ride here and there, take him to the grocery store. John was very dependent on us. I guess it's kind of both of our faults because we knew John had, you know, issues growing up. And maybe we overprotected him, so he relied on us a lot to take care of him. I mean, even though he had his job and his own money because he's working two jobs, but what I'm saying is I don't think he would just stop calling us. That's the only other thing I can think. I just think John had a lot of stress and pressure on him. I think his dad was pressuring him too hard on working both of those jobs. I think his dad really wanted to quit the Q Club. And I don't blame his dad. It's not a good place to work at, from what I understand. There's a lot of drugs and stuff dealing, you know, going underneath the table there. But John loved pool. That was his dream job. He worked in a billiards. He could play all the pool he wanted. He got to play in leagues. He played with professional players. That was a dream. He loved that job. So why would he just walk away from that job and walk away from his family without a trace of any evidence of anything?
Anna doesn't believe that John would just walk away without contacting his family, but she does hold some concerns that he may be out there living amongst the vast homeless population. When we spoke with her, she shared that her kids were raised with the skills to survive.
He can survive because, let me tell you, his dad is a survivalist. He taught his kids how to survive. I think he could survive for a little while. How long? I don't know. I mean, you got to understand, he has been living with his dad for the last 4 years for sure. So I don't know if he's taken him out and taught him any more stuff, but I can tell you, growing up their whole lives, he's always taught him survival skills.
Despite having the ability to survive, Anna remains worried that some of John's mental health problems may have caused him additional challenges after he disappeared.
Even growing up in school, he had a hard time in school with ADHD. He does not remember. He doesn't memorize very well at all. So I feel like my son is like maybe disoriented or still freaked out because he can't remember any of our numbers here. So he can't contact us. So that's going to keep him still anxious. And if he even remembers us, I mean, I just don't feel like something's right in his mind.
While John's mom believes that it's possible that her son met with foul play at the time of his disappearance, his dad has a completely different take on what happened. John was just starting to gain some independence, make his own decisions, and do what he wanted with his time and money. According to his dad, this is what he thinks happened.
He was saving up to get a car and, hopefully get his life started and get his own place to live. And I'm guessing what happened is he met a girl or had a girlfriend that talked him into doing this, and they both ran off together. I assume that's what happened. And I went into one of these marijuana dispensary places and showed them the pictures there. And they said, "You bet, we've seen him. He's been in here before with this girl." And some girl there at the queue, I don't know her name. I don't know anything about her other than he was playing pool with her from time to time. And apparently he's with her most of the time. I guess they're both out on the street. I don't know. I think he's capable of that. I think he would have contacted somebody. It could be that he's with this girl and she's talked him into. And again, all these years as he's growing up in high school and stuff, he really wanted to have female relationship with a girl, some kind of romantic intimacy and whatever, and it just never happened. And first time somebody paid attention to him, he's gone. She was paying attention to him, and he would tell me about it once in a while. I never met her. Thought that if it was getting serious enough that I would eventually meet her, but I think they ran off together. But when I saw those pictures, I really felt good that he's alive and out there in the world somewhere. And so I started feeling a lot better about it. I'd still like to talk to him, but he's 30 years old and he's an adult. If he wants to be out there and do what he's doing, then that's what he wants, then I'm good with it. I'm okay. I wouldn't mind seeing him and talk to him once in a while. And, if he wants to go have a life somewhere else, then that's okay. I'm okay with it. I just like to talk to him one more time. I feel bad about it. And John's my son, and I love him, and I take care of him all. But as long as I know that he's okay and this was his idea, then I'm okay with it. If it's what he wants, if somebody's hurt him, if he's dead somewhere, then I'm not okay with it.
Eric fears that his friend is no longer alive. This is what he told us he believes happened to John.
There's no way he would have done it on his own. He's never been the type that, just have a full-time job, steady, own vehicle or anything like that. He's been more of a, personally, he's more of a mama's boy than anything, you know, because he talked to his mama every day, still gone. And pretty much, you know, growing up, that's what he relied on was his mama. You know, he didn't just have his own responsibilities too much. Moving out there to Vegas, he was living with his dad for most of the time until like past like 5 months before he became missing. His dad gave the house to his brother, him and his brother. Yeah, but see, my biggest thing is, though, is if he would have just up and left, you know, his cigarettes, you know, he didn't take his cigarettes. Most smokers are going to leave and not take their cigarettes. I smoke, you know, there's no way in hell I'm leaving for a week or 2 weeks and not have the cigarettes I paid for with me. I mean, I think he definitely has survival instincts for a good while anyway. Sure, he can make it on his own. But I believe that he would end up definitely getting lonely and be missing certain things of his life, something to his mom for sure. Personally, I believe, you know, he left with a friend or a so-called friend the day that he came missing and never returned. And something might have happened by accident or something, and he possibly died. That's what I think happened there. I feel like somebody he was close enough with came to pick him up.
So what happened to Jonathan Hall on February 13th, 2019? We know that he worked with his dad that day, who dropped him off at his home. John would usually go to sleep for a few hours before heading to his shift at the Q Club, but it appears that he went there earlier on this day. One of the other employees remembers seeing him around 7:30 p.m., and that was the last known sighting of John. Missing along with John are things that he always carried with him, including his backpack, wallet, keys, cell phone, and gun. He left his moped behind at home, and it didn't appear that he took anything that would indicate that he planned to be gone for an extended period of time. Anna told us that his cell phone records showed that one text message she sent John made it through at 2:38 a.m., but he never replied back, and at 6:42 a.m., some data was used. After that, his phone has been off and never turned back on again. Attempts have been made to locate the phone by the carrier and Google, but all attempts have failed. Did John choose to leave with the young woman his dad thinks that he had been seeing? Did he owe someone money and they harmed him? Did the person who broke into his home return again? If he was planning to walk away, why didn't he take some of his belongings or the money in his bank account? Could John have left with the intent to harm himself? Could he be living amongst the vast homeless population in Las Vegas? What about those sightings where people were nearly certain they had seen John? Are they just seeing the same man who looks similar to him? Or could he still be out there somewhere? At the time of his disappearance, Jonathan Hall was 30 years old. He's approximately 5'5" tall and weighs around 130 pounds. He has blonde hair and green eyes. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jonathan Hall, please call the Las Vegas Metro Police Department at 702-828-3111.
There's been other pictures I've found on Facebook. I know, you ever heard of Care Complex? It's out in Las Vegas. It's like a homeless. Okay, well, they had posted some pictures. And I'm going to tell you, as a mother, there's people standing outside the gate, okay? And automatically, my eyes zoomed in on this young man on that picture. I said, that's my son. And I cut it out. I zoomed in on it. His body, the way he's standing. And guess what? John went missing with hiking boots when he left. This dude had hiking boots on. It's hot as crap outside, okay? He had hiking boots on. He fit the description, but there's a little bar right in front of his face, so you couldn't see his complete face. But he was holding the bottom of his shirt. When John's nervous or anything, he fidgets with the bottom of his shirt. He always had a tag, a blankie, when he was all the way up until he was 12 or 13 years old. So when he gets upset or nervous or, you know, feels anxious or whatever, he'll tug on the bottom of his shirt. This guy was holding the bottom of his shirt rolled up like John. And I swear to God, I thought that was my son.
It'd be nice to talk to him and, you know, give him a hug and tell him good luck on whatever endeavor he wants to do. And I just hope he's okay somewhere, you know. He doesn't have a temper, he doesn't get mad, and he's got a big heart, and he loves to help people out anytime he can, and he has.
Nobody's really telling me anything on what has been done, if anything's been found that relates him to Jonathan or has anything to do with my son. But don't give me a lot of information on what's going on with this case. Pretty much, there were several detectives working the case, and pretty much what I've gotten told, basically, in a roundabout way, John's basically a cold case. He'll sit on, you know, the files or whatever until they have someone who can come in there who has time to go try to dig up and pull it out and try to hope they can solve it. That's kind of how I took it. Two of the guys were really working it, but then, y'all, I mean, you know how Las Vegas is. There are constantly a lot of crime going on, and they're constantly being tied up in active cases. So John is not considered in one of those kind of cases. He's really a cold case. So his case will get work done whenever somebody has spare time, basically. Why would he just vanish? Does not make a sense, you know, no sense to me. My son didn't up and just vanish. He didn't. This is not done by choice. So I think the father and the son know exactly what happened with my son. I think they both know something. The son ain't talking. He definitely is not going to speak.
We originally brought you the story of Jonathan Hall just over 2 years ago, in early December of 2019. Unfortunately, John is still missing today. But there has been one major turn of events that reignited John's case, and we wanted to share these updates with you as the case continues to evolve. According to local news reports, on October 27th, 2020, John's brother, Stephen, was arrested by Las Vegas police and was accused of stabbing three people. He was charged with two counts of murder with the use of a deadly weapon, one count of attempted murder, and two counts of battery with the use of a deadly weapon, resulting in substantial bodily harm. Stephen remains incarcerated pending trial in this case. As you heard in the original episode, there had been some suspicions about John's brother, but they were under the impression that he had been ruled out. But now, they aren't sure what to think. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 323 of The Vanished, an update on Jonathan Hall's story. We had been watching for more news to come after Stephen was arrested. We hoped that this would be the break that John's case needed, but we didn't see much happening. We caught up with John's mom, Anna, who was Stephen's former stepmom, and asked her what has taken place since we talked to her 2 years ago.
The brother, you know, was arrested for murder. After John went missing, he all of a sudden is a murderer. You know, he stabbed three homeless men. Two of them have died. One of them, you know, sustained some serious injuries. You all recall, I don't remember if we said it on the first podcast, but, you know, as soon as John went missing, it wasn't but a few days later, that brother went missing for weeks. You know, he was gone for a while. They didn't find him until about 3 weeks, probably after my daughter left Las Vegas. And then they found him in supposedly a homeless population is how they found him. I think he got pulled over and had a gun without a license or a carry permit or something. So I think that's how they actually ended up finding him when they did question him. And of course, when the detective questioned him, he just said, you know, he's definitely an odd person and all that, but he didn't find him to be a murderer. You know, he's 40-something years old. He's never committed a crime. He has no record. He don't see him just snapping and becoming a murderer, which I tried to tell them he's very seriously mentally ill. That anything's possible. He's one of those, you know, I mean, he was my son at one point. I was married into the family. You know, the detective, one man said, I can't see him being, you know, just turning into a murderer, but yet look what happened. He killed two men and almost killed another man. So it does happen.
We weren't able to obtain any court documents related to Stephen's charges and haven't been able to determine if he's undergone any psychological evaluation or has any mental health diagnosis, though Anna said some of his behaviors have always been strange. We don't know what occurred that would have led to this triple stabbing, but we do know that one man died at the scene, another a few months later from complications from his stab wounds, and the third man survived. Stephen was tied to the crime by DNA recovered at the scene. He was arrested just a couple of weeks after the stabbing. We also spoke to John's cousin William, and he told us about his relationship with John, and also gave us some more insight on the difficult family dynamic aspect of this story.
Well, when he was growing up, I was living in Las Vegas, and he was living in Tennessee. So he only visited a few times when he was little. We're quite different in age. I'm 50, and he would have been like 32. I grew up mostly with his sister, Hannah. Him and his sister, Amber, were small children when I was already growing up. When he moved to Utah to take care of our grandfather, I got more acquainted with him as he was older. He was kind of shy and reserved for the most part, but he enjoyed shooting pool and hanging out with his cousin Jared and in St. George at that time. And then he would have hung out with me more, but me and his father had a falling out, so he kind of feared his father. So he wouldn't want to be around his father because he always feared his father. You know, he was afraid of what his dad was going to say or scold or tell him, you know, what he's doing wrong in life. His dad didn't really have the warmth thing. Okay, well, I'm proud of what you're doing. I'm proud of this or proud of that. But it was always, oh, no, you're not doing good enough. You're not this. You're not that. You're not doing this. You're not, you know, nothing was ever good enough.
You heard in the original episode that the relationship between John's parents had at times been strained. And we wanted to ask William about his perspective on that and why John would have feared his dad. This is what he told us.
I wasn't talking to his father at the time. His father had pulled a gun on me and threatened to kill me. So we got into a big screaming match and shouting match. He had claimed that I had done some things that were not true and proven not to be true. So his house had gotten burglarized, and that house had been burglarized probably 20 times over the past 10, 15 years. For some reason, he thought that I had something to do with it. And I was working two jobs at the time, and I was on camera all the time at my jobs. I was on camera working at the time that he claimed that I was assisting in burglarizing his home. I was cut and dry. But I wanted to go talk to him and reconcile, say, hey, look, you know, I've proven I'm at work, man. So can we hash this out when we talk about it? No. That's when he pulled the gun on me and told me you never want to see me again, blah, blah, blah. You know, so. And that's how that ended.
We were surprised to hear about such extreme behavior, but William told us that there was even more, which gave us a new point of view.
My cousin Hannah, too, his sister, I was talking to her at the time. They were close. She was the only one that he would really listen to when it came down to defying his dad or going against his dad's wishes or anything like that. Because his dad was definitely on the unstable side of reality. He has like some delusions of about apocalypse and different things like that that he tried to convince me when we were actually in, and I kind of laughed it off and shrugged it off. I was like, oh, okay, yeah. And then he got angry, you know, because I thought he was joking, honestly, because it was so off the wall. I thought he was just like, you know, joking around. And when I talked to my cousin Hannah, she was like, oh, you did that. And ooh, that's not good, because he had his like weapons and bags and stuff prepared for like end times and apocalypse type stuff. So he has these like food rations and things stowed away in different duffel bags and hidden away in basement and attic. And she said that he's extremely serious about his government conspiracies and end times and apocalypse type stuff. Because I honestly thought he was just joking, and so I kind of laughed it off, triggered it off, and he got really angry about it. And I was the fool. And I'm like, well, I'm not quite prepared for a zombie apocalypse yet, but I'll get on it.
Despite John's dad's altercation with William and the other unconventional behaviors, Anna shared with us that she doesn't believe John's father had anything to do with his disappearance.
I don't think his father is the one responsible for doing anything to his son, but I feel like his other son did, and he's protecting the other son. That's just my heart felt inside my heart. You know, he's a father who has two sons, and I just really feel like he knows what happened, and he's helped protect him. You know, he upped and moved, sold the house. He upped and moved to another place out in Nevada, which was very shocking to me because that was his childhood home, the father's home, childhood home. You know, the whole reason he left the kids here was to move there. So his dad was giving him that home, and that was his childhood home. He didn't want to lose it. He wanted to keep it in the family. But, you know, as soon as John goes missing, and he was quick to sell that house exactly 1 year later, and he done moved out of town. I mean, he done moved away from Las Vegas. I don't know. It's a lot of things don't add up. You know, a lot of the stories, information that was put out there on the last podcast, you know, him making the comment about John disappearing with some girlfriend, that is purely made up. I mean, people I've talked to at his job and stuff, you know, pretty much John did not have a girlfriend. They know him. They worked with him, and he opened up to the people that he worked with. He was real close to several people out there, and they knew. I mean, he would tell me that. He wouldn't hide a girl. He'd be proud to tell me about a girlfriend. He told me about a girl he used to like, you know, out there. So why would he keep that a secret, and why would he just vanish with her? Too, as a father, if you're closest to John, you know, you are saying you are, why would you left Vegas that quick? When you know those are the only two places that he would have went back to is your house and the other house. That's the only two places he knew to go to as far as his father. If he was mentally off or unstable, that's where he would have went back to where, you know, if John did resurface, he wouldn't be able to get in touch with him or find him, especially if somebody stole the cell phone. I kept the cell phone on because I'm the one who pays the bill. I was the one who got him the cell phone in the first place. I kept it on for as long as I could, and I'm like, you know, the phone has never came back on. You know, the police had a thing on it. If it came on, that the AT&T would contact them. But the phone never came back on. The last text message it got to John was from me the following Friday after he disappeared. He disappeared on that 13th. So that Friday of that week was the last text message at 2 something in the morning that I sent John. Somebody read it and turned the phone back off, and the phone never came back on. But the whole time, you know, from the time, John, that the 13th, 14th, 15th, somebody was messing with that phone. John never does that. John has never turned off his phone, turned it on, turned it off, turned it on like that. You know what I'm saying? Somebody was checking the phone and turning it on and off, which makes me feel like the brother is responsible. I think the brother had something to do with that.
With John missing for so long and no new information coming in, Anna eventually turned off John's phone, since it appeared to have died, been powered off, or destroyed.
I mean, I paid for the phone for almost a year and a half later. I had to turn it off because, I mean, it was just mentally stressing me out, waiting, the praying and hoping a message would come through from that number. I sent a message to his phone every night, a prayer to it every night. You know, if he ever turned it back on, he'd get those messages. But I had to face reality. It wasn't happening. Somebody had the phone. Somebody had done took the phone, broke it, did whatever with it. Because it never, ever came back on. The phone company was never able to get a ping off of it after that. Of course, y'all know, you know, the ping, the last ping was all around the area of where his brother worked. According to his dad said that, you know, his son remembers hearing him coming in the house, he thought. But then he changed his mind. You know, he changed his story later down the line. So, I don't know.
Since his arrest, Stephen has been incarcerated, and he evidently made indications that he doesn't know who John is, or that he has a brother at all, which of course is very odd. This is what Anna told us about that.
His cousin has gone to visit that son a few times, and he tries to pretend like he doesn't know who Jonathan is. Like he acts like he can't remember who his own brother is that he lived with in that house. He's acting like John, who he's never asked, has anybody found John or anything about Jonathan? He's not even concerned or mentioned his brother. He just acts like he don't know who Jonathan is. You live with him. How you not know who he is? He's your brother. So that's got me pretty frustrated. I know that they were going to try to talk to the brother to find out if he, basically to see if they can plea bargain with him, to see if he was talk and say he had any involvement with Jonathan's disappearance or not, and then try to offer something, you know, to him. But he totally told them that he knows nothing about what happened to Jonathan or anything to do with Jonathan. So he's playing the card, that card. So he's refusing to talk to them. He's refusing to answer any questions or anything when they try to use that, you know, try to question him.
We asked William about his visits to the jail to see Stephen.
I visited Stephen several times, you know, getting him to, talk about the crime that he's accused of. And then I tried to see if he was willing to talk about his brother at all. And he lived with Jonathan at the time of his disappearance. And when he was arrested, of course, we were extremely suspicious that he may have had something to do with it, because he is also a person of interest during the original investigation, like because of cell phone records and things are, I believe they were like near where Stephen Jr. worked at the time. So he was a person of interest. And so that's why I went to go talk to Stephen Jr. because I really wanted to get into his head a little bit and mention John and say, hey, did the same similar kind of rage or thing happen? And you did something to John and you had to run because he was on the run for like 2 weeks. Nobody knew where he was at after John disappeared. He was on the run and hiding.
William told us that the way the jail visit went was not what he expected.
I went to go visit him because I wanted to see if he would mention John or talk about John or anything like that. And when I originally first talked to him in the jail, it's all video chat. So you're not actually a physical person, you know, first face to face. You're on a video screen and like a handheld phone. So it's hard to gauge body language. You know, it's kind of like a delay in the video. It's not a huge delay, but there is a slight delay. But when I did mention him, I mean, his eyes went down and turned. That was very disconcerting to me because, you know, with that body language that he did show on video, it seemed to me like another guilty person not wanting to, you know, remembering something but not wanting to say anything about it, you know. Because at first he pretended like he didn't know who John was. I had to say, John, you know, your brother. And he's like, oh yeah. The first visits I went with him, he was very, I would say, frazzled, like mentally drained, not quite there, kind of a ghost of his self.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Back when John disappeared in 2019, there were suspicions about Stephen due to his behaviors, taking off, and phone pings. But John and Stephen's father told us that the police had ruled him out. Anna mentioned that investigators told her back then that they didn't believe that Stephen was capable of murder. But then, Stephen was charged with murdering two men and attempting to kill a third in a violent attack. This has changed everything for John's family. And to them, they feel like there might be more to this, and the strange things surrounding Stephen might be more than coincidental. When Stephen was arrested, they seized his vehicle. Anna was hopeful that they would find some evidence inside connecting him to John. Though he's been in jail for over a year now, the struggle to make progress in John's disappearance has not gotten any easier, which Anna told us has been a huge source of disappointment and frustration for her.
Well, there still hasn't really been a lot done. COVID hit, it slowed everything down. I mean, pretty much we've only had one hit or lead several months ago of a guy. A lady took a picture of a homeless guy standing with a sign that, you know, resembled John quite a bit, very, very close. And I, you know, sent it in to the detectives and everything. And of course, nothing could be confirmed because by the time the lady sent it out and sent somebody out there, nobody could find this guy again. He hasn't been seen again. Other than that, I mean, that's pretty much all that's been done on my son's case. I'm really frustrated and fed up that there's been stuff I've given him and nobody's checked out. Nobody's calling nobody and questioning people that should have been questioned. I feel like they dropped the bomb on my son's case from the beginning. And I feel like the reason they did that is because the way the father filed the complaint, you know, that his son was missing, he kind of made it sound like he possibly chose to walk away. And that's what they treated as a missing person, that he's an adult, he chose to walk away. John's case would have been handled differently, quicker. But they had 3 to 4 weeks to clean up any evidence in the house, anything around that house, before my daughter got out there and had a crime scene investigator, you know, come do an investigation out there. And that's another thing, you know, it's like they do all this stuff, but they won't tell you anything. They won't tell you, you know, other than they didn't find anything. They didn't tell you if they searched outside around the house, if they searched the garage. You know, how in depth did they go? Did you search every room in that house? I mean, there's just some things that I don't understand why they can't tell. Well, I'm not supposed to know any of that.
We asked Anna if Stephen's arrest has had any impact on the investigation into John's case, or if he's considered a person of interest today.
They were trying to find out if he was connected to Jonathan's disappearance or had anything to do with Jonathan's disappearance. They wouldn't go into detail, but they was just letting me know now that there's the murder cases that they're, you know, he actually committed murder, that they, you know, I guess find him suspicious. You know, find it more suspicious now that he actually is a murderer, that he could actually kill. And that's how I found out, you know, that the DNA was being checked in the vehicle and all that. But it's been a while since I've dealt with them anymore, because pretty much, I mean, they did whatever they had to do. Supposedly they were going to go back through the phone records and all that. And here we go again. I still ain't been told what's been done or what's not been done. So I don't know what got done. All I know now, it seems like it's at a standstill. They could be working behind, you know, they did, you know, say things could be going on behind the scene, behind the doors, you know. They wasn't going to give up on John's case. At least the one dude, the one man, the one detective said, you know, as long as he's working there, that, you know, he would not give up on trying to solve John's case when he had his, you know, was able to have time to work with John's case. But he's in, you know, a very different department, and then his department stays busy with homicide out there. You know, there's constantly deaths and stuff going on out there, shootings and stuff. So you don't really get a lot of free time. And the other guy retired. So, yeah, like I said, I just feel like a lot of things, the ball was dropped. I understand, you know, Las Vegas has a handful of this stuff going on out there. There's a lot of missing people. And I understand, you know, the elderly and children are going to come first. That's totally understandable. I just really wish they wouldn't they would have sent them out right away. Things should have been took a little bit more serious. You know, at the time, you don't think about these things until years. You know, this is turning almost 3 years. And this is something that will never stop going through my head, you know. The brother was very jealous of John. He is quite capable of why he, you know, all of a sudden would, you know, just snap and, you know, if he did harm John, whether he murder him or hit him in the head and cause some kind of trauma, I guess he's just going to walk scot-free on that one. You know, he will remain in prison. I just wish justice would be done if he did do something to my son. I mean, he obviously knows something. Why are you pretending like you don't know who your brother is anymore? I mean, I know they're only going to tell you what they want you to know, and they're going to only tell you so much because they don't want anything to interfere with any investigation. They don't want certain information getting out there that would hurt John's case. But I'm not going to keep being quiet because they're not telling me anything. You're not telling me what you have done. I've gave them people's names that want to talk to them that would gladly speak to them about, you know, certain things that happened. You know, one of his friends, she said she would talk to him, and I gave them her phone number and everything. So far as I know, from what she said last, they have not called her or contacted her. And I've gave them other information, and obviously nothing's been able to be done. They don't have time to go out and do the things that they were going to do. Like go to the Q Club and talk to people out there, you know. They were supposed to go out there and do that. And from the last, probably about a few weeks ago, one of the detectives actually retired. Or he did retire, matter of fact, just recently. They never made it out to the Q Club.
We shared in John's original episode, as well as in other Las Vegas stories that we've covered, that the Las Vegas Metro Police Department has never responded to any of our requests for records or interviews. That seems to be the same way that family members are treated, and how Anna continues to be treated despite the fact that her son has now been missing for years. And there's someone in his close circle who stands accused of murder.
I had asked for a new bolo flower because, you know, the one the police created has a very old picture of John. John's always had facial mustache type hair on his face. He did not have a clean shaven face. That picture was from years ago, back when he first got his dad was going to church. And it looked nothing like him, so I asked him would he use updated pictures. But we had updated pictures of Jonathan because I always video time, you know, FaceTime him, you know, snap pictures of him. And then when Eric, his, you know, friend from down here actually was up there, he took a picture for me because I asked him to. You get a good picture of my son while you're there? And I was like 2018, so that was the most recent picture. And then somebody from work sent me a picture. He doesn't seem to want to do it. Nobody. Nothing, not a single lead, not a single trace of nothing, according to them. The circumstantial stuff. And circumstantial, I'm not being told, again, you know, like I said, what has been done? Was there anything found in that van, or was there not anything found in that van that belonged to John? Was his phone in there? I even asked him that when he got arrested. I said, could y'all check and find out what phone he's got? You know, let him know, this is the phone. Here, I can get the model number and serial, which I can tell you from AT&T, but I never got told whether or not the phone was there, was, you know, was that phone or not. So, I mean, I don't understand, you know, I get some things you can tell people, some things you can't, but I mean, that's not really, not real serious. Was that going to harm my son's case? Was that his phone or was it not my son's phone? I just wish I could, you know, I knew what they actually done on his case. I would like to know. What have y'all done? What was done pertaining to Jonathan and him? Anything? Was anything found? I guess I can't tell you that because it is an open case and it's invested, you know, it is a murder case. They're dealing with him on the murder cases right now. They can't tie him to Jonathan, as far as I'm told.
As far as connecting John's disappearance to Stephen's alleged crimes and criminal history, Anna told us that she's frustrated by the delays in Stephen's court hearings.
It's been an ongoing, keeps getting postponed, delayed, because he's playing the system. They had his property, the van, the brother's van. They did supposedly do some DNA search for John's DNA in that van. I mean, it keeps being postponed. It's already, you know, it was supposed to be November court date.
Toward the end of our conversation, we asked Anna where she stands on what she believes happened to her son and what is happening in her own search for answers 2 years after we asked her the same difficult question.
At this point, I guess it's not important. He's gone this long. They're pretty much assuming, I guess, he's deceased. So somebody's going to really go out and check anything out is what kind of how I feel in my mind. I feel like they're not checking anything because they really pretty much probably think he's deceased because they probably think the brother did do something to him. But yeah, you have told me y'all have no evidence to prove it. So that's where we stand. It's really frustrating. Of course, you have people that are always contacting you trying to act like they're psychics. They can tell you what happened to him, you know, what happened to John and all that. And I kind of let them have their spiel. And, you know, a lot of them keep saying, they think he's homeless and he's mentally, you know, unstable. Like a part of me is holding on to a little thread of hope that he could still be out there alive because of that last picture of that guy looks so much like him. But so did the one, a couple ones before that, you know. I got my hopes up and it wasn't him. So now I just try not to really get my hopes up. You know, part of me trying to face it and move on and say, you know, okay, he's gone. He's never coming back. Because if he was alive, he would have found a way back by now. Unless something is wrong with him or someone's holding him against his will. And we have no information. We don't know if he is being held against his will. We don't know if he's alive or if he's not alive. I have absolutely nothing. Nothing. If they have anything, they've not let me know.
We still don't know what happened to Jonathan, whether his disappearance was voluntary, accidental, or a criminal act. But the charges filed against his brother certainly add a whole new dimension to the suspicions that John's family already had about his brother 2 years ago, when we first aired his story. Anna continues her fight to find John and answers about what happened to him, despite the lack of communication from the police, to which she has become accustomed to. At the time of his disappearance, Jonathan Hall was 30 years old. He is approximately 5'5" tall and weighed around 130 pounds. He has blonde hair and green eyes. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jonathan Hall, please call the Las Vegas Metro Police Department at 702-828-3111.
The only thing we've got active going is still sharing the flyer out there on social media. I don't know if anybody's handing flyers on the ground out there anymore. Like I said, a lot of people have dropped off the case now. A lot of people are not even, it just kind of faded away. I've only got a few that stuck with me that's from his job that still, you know, share or follow his story. And I've got, you know, another group that got started out there, the Chris Turner. You know, y'all did Chris Turner's case. His mother, they've got a group now that's working with me with Jonathan's case out there. So hopefully they are able to get stuff out on the ground. Anybody wants to help? I mean, yeah. I'm more than welcome to help because I can't do so much from here on the computer.
That brings us to the end of episode 323. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple of things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Next week, we'll be taking a week off to spend the holidays with our families. But be sure to tune in on January 3rd for a new story from Massachusetts. Thanks for listening.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.